Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats and proud member of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. I'm your host and expert layman, Matt Goodwin, and I am joined, as always, by your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. On this episode, we will talk a little bit more about Camden Yards and Wooded Dong, K percentage and WRC+, and Jorge Mateo as the poster child for when to roster one category contributors or not. But before we get to all of that, Alexander, how you doing?
You know, it's been a pretty okay week so far. Yeah, I'm slowly but surely, as like the actual school year sort of comes to the end. I hear you might know something about that too. starting to get my like summer schedule sorted, which is like going to feature me like working 9 to 5. That's really weird. I didn't know that people did that. So I'm trying to get oriented back to that, and I'm excited that might mean I like get home and like watch baseball more regularly because I haven't been doing it very much.
That's a significant change over the like mornings off and then afternoons and evenings kind of existence that you've lived for a while.
Yeah. And I'm okay with that for sure. Like I'm quite happy to like have some regularity for like the near future. I'm sure, you know, like the trade-off is like after this, it'll be like 9 to 9 and such for like the rest of my life or whatever. But like,
yeah, that's probably the truth. Enjoy this schedule change and having your evenings. Is getting up going to feel weird?
I mean, I already do that because I have to make coffee in the morning. Like, that's my job.
Oh, okay. All right. See, if I didn't have to work until like 2 in the afternoon, I don't think coffee would be my job. But I have kids, so kids would be my job, and I wouldn't be able to sleep in now. But
Oh yeah, I should say
the good old days.
there was a time in like my senior year of college whenever I was working for the campus newspaper where I would get off work sometime around 1 or 1:30, depending on the night. Mm-hmm. And then I would go home and play video games for a couple hours after that and then wake up at noon.
Right.
Like, we're not quite at that anymore.
I'm shifting your entire human existence at that point.
You know, I put all my classes in the afternoon on purpose. So I was pretty happy with it. But yeah, my future this fall, as far as I understand it, is that I'll have class at like 8 or 9 a.m. and this will not be feasible in the same way as kind of like I'm making it happen right now. So whatever. Be excited about what you can, I guess, right?
Yeah, no, that's a super fair point. Absolutely. Are you shifting your actual work, or is it just shifting the schedule of the work?
Well, it's like during the summer, you know, I think you've heard, as I said, kids stop doing that whole going to school thing.
So that means
that they're available to like learn stuff for me instead. So that's the whole idea, is I will be like in the office teaching kids stuff. From like 9 to whenever my day ends during the week.
But you don't have to work it around a regular school day. I got you.
Right, okay.
That makes sense. My summer is going to be very much jam-packed, probably like 16-hour days, but it's going to all be daddy duty. So it's just a different kind of work. But I've got great kids, so I really can't complain.
I mean, that is absolutely work. It's worth saying in case anyone doubts that even for a second. And I don't even have any of that work on my plate. I mean, my cat potty trained itself pretty quickly and doesn't know how to cry more than like a little bit. So like, best of luck to you. That you got the real job, I'm sure.
Well, I know I brought it on myself. All right. Let's move into what you have labeled in our rundown, our guest rundown creator, my co-host, Alexander Chase, called the warm-up. I like it. I really do. That's not what we usually have written in here, but I think it works. It makes sense. It fits our shtick. It's good. It's something we might keep around.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking, like, I don't really want this to be the shtick for today's episode, but I figure, like, there's always some odd or end I've seen someone like throw out there that they're curious about on Twitter, or, you know, someone says something that kind of like sets me off into the, I should do like a mild amount of work to figure out what the answer is to this. You know, I don't ever like to like write about the things that I research necessarily.
Yeah.
But I thought this was a fun sort of thing to get up. So the other day, we still follow Wooded Dong, obviously. What a great account. I just love the visuals, you know, like being able to see the ball curve in the air and like land in weird places in the park. Fun. And I saw that for the third time this season, a batter recorded a "it would have been a home run anywhere else" hit at Camden Yards. And it's important to note, yeah, this was Julio Rodriguez hit like a 100 mile an hour double that went like deep into the corner where they've like put the wall back. And yeah, according to Woodadong, it would have been a home run in 29 out of 30 ballparks. Only Oriole Park at Camden Yards would have held this one in. That is their third such batted ball this season. All three of those in Camden Yards have been hits, which is a nice thing. At least it's not, we're not like leading to a bunch of flyouts. There have only been 12 such batted balls all year, and three out of those 12 have been Camden. So,
okay, so not 12 just in Camden, 12 in all of Major League Baseball. Well, right. I mean, with what they did with the wall, it doesn't sound like, I guess only would have been not home runs in Camden is a pretty big deal because there's a lot of other smaller ballparks, I guess. But if you had told me, honestly, if you had said with this new change, there have been 12 batted balls that would have been home runs everywhere except Camden Yards, I probably would have believed you. But you're right. I mean, 3 out of 12 is still a super significant percentage. And it piggybacks on what we were talking about before, right? In terms of like the impact of this and all the stuff that Aaron Judge had said about create a park and that sort of thing.
Yeah. What got me thinking is I was like, should we care about this particular number? And also, is that a lot? It was kind of a weird thing to wrap my head around. And I think you already kind of got to the idea that I was at. It's like, that's a big percentage of those. So then you get to thinking, how many 25 of 30s, how many 20 of 30 balls have been flyouts into that little divot or whatever? And also, how often last year were they getting home runs where they were like 5 of 30s? So like, it doesn't take a whole lot to just be like, set that ball in motion mentally. I know I've seen some pretty interesting pieces out there. I think someone at Baseball Prospectus wrote out about how like really, really excellent a job it's done of like making it viable to be a left-handed pitcher in Camden. It's way beyond what we would hope for. But like, it's an interesting thought there. I also should note, when I originally tweeted this out, I had it at 7, and I realized I got the query wrong because I like forgot to separately look for how Woodadong talks about their unicorn outs. They tweet out like the doubles that are 29 of 30 differently than the flyouts in those situations. So there's a couple of their parks. Do you want to guess which other ballparks have had any such victims this year?
Oh, that is interesting. So it's a ball that's hit that would be a home run anywhere but the place it's hit. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes. Oh, I should note, okay. I just refreshed the search. There is another one today. Ryan McMahon had one in Coors. So I will give that away as like the obvious answer. There's a triple that he hit that would have been out everywhere else that he'll hit into like their deepest corner, which is really funny.
Okay,
so see the parks that would have been out anywhere else.
Doing this though, let's clarify for me. We're talking about balls. So I hit the ball, and it is a home run here, but wouldn't have been a home run anywhere else.
The other way around.
Okay, I didn't know if we had shifted gears. That's the unicorn thing, right? That you were talking about.
Well, they do both. The thing is, they use the word unicorn to describe both the 1 of 30 home runs, and then the 29 of 30 flyouts. So I like did my search wrong because like the 29 of 30 doubles, they don't call unicorns. If you're listening at Woodadong, which I assume is a sentient bot account, I would change that personally, but you know, who am I? So that's just a small thing to consider.
I think some interesting information, and you shared this, came out about Coors in terms of like where it stands as a home run giver or taker away, right? Do you want to talk about that for just a half a second before I make a silly guess about another park that has victimized people?
Sure. So a nice thing that I get to say about Savant, I say mean things about them, so I should say nice things about them too when they're merited, and they are definitely merited here. Tom Tango shared a blog post about how they updated their ex-home run leaders and like all that stuff by factoring in like elevation and weather a little bit differently and like appropriately into their ex-home run leaderboards. So if you go and look at like any Colorado Rocky or whatever, they're like normal now. It's not just distance. So if you look at Coors, like they do the appropriate factoring. So instead of saying that like so-and-so would have only hit 18 home runs instead of 35 if they played in Colorado, they're like, no, he still would have like hit a lot. That's always been broken. That's the sort of thing where it's like, if you've known it's been broken, it's been really easy to like not say a dumb thing about it and like just work around it. We always say it's good to know where things are broke so that you can work around it rather than just complain about those things. And this is like one where it's a known good issue. And finally, they just fixed it. I'm excited to be able to talk about Coors appropriately.
Well, I, as a Red Sox fan, and I'm guessing here, I have thought of the Green Monster, and this is just like anecdotal observation, eye test kind of a thing, that what the wall in Boston gives is the opportunity to turn some fly balls that would be outs elsewhere into wall scraper singles. But that it takes a lot of scorched balls that hit on the upper third that would have been home runs probably anywhere else and turns them into long singles, really, really hard hit singles because it hits that wall and comes back in. So the, you know, obviously the angle, if you hit the ball super, super hard at Fenway, you have to also have achieved a certain angle if you're trying to get it over the monster. So I don't know if there's any truth to that. And it'll be interesting for me to find out one way or the other. But it just felt like there's, I've seen some games where balls have been absolutely crushed and they've hit, you know, 10 feet below the top of the monster and like on a line. And you have to imagine that in any other stadium that would have been a home run.
And you bring up the exact thing that Woody Dunn can't track because it does distance and not like projected velocity based off of if there weren't any walls. So they don't show up. But that's like okay. A totally fair point that like, probably they just can't catch. So sure, like sure. You're for sure right without being right in the terms of like absolute sense. I actually immediately thought, I was like, don't they have like a really deep right field piece that would be, I guess they're probably on the low end, but they aren't the unicorn spot anywhere. That is a good guess though, I would say. What other sorts of like I hate this parks come to mind for you?
In terms of that particular thing, I'm really struggling now to try and come up with another place that would have such unique, okay. So I'm going to preface this with saying I'm trying to think of a place that has really unique dimensions, right? If it's,
you know, that's not the only way to go. I mean, if you think unique is just big, yes, you'll get this.
Yeah, I guess that's true, because if we're not talking about like fence heights and hills and weird, quirky things, we're talking about distance, right?
Yeah.
Like St. Louis?
No, I'm sure they are probably like not a great place, but they don't have any singularly like most unpleasant dimensions. I'll give you one more.
One more guess. Okay. Oakland.
You know, another one that I would have thought of, but haven't had any. So I'll just run down a couple of them and you'll be like, oh yeah, duh, of course. Oracle Park, Giants have a couple of them that have been responsible. Kauffman Stadium, the Royals, has some pretty deep fences in some parts. Comerica Park for the Tigers, I mean, duh, that one's really deep in some obvious spots. The Twins at like straightaway center have stolen a couple. And then, and this is a really weird thing, the left field porch for guaranteed rate field for the White Sox has a couple spots where you would have expected where it's like the worst, but like just a couple spots. So it's interesting. It's like you just got to be, as you go around the major league wide hypothetical bar park, you just have to be the one spot and someone has to hit it there. Whereas a lot of the parks that we would think of are either A, weird in some ways, won't show up here, or just B, generally awful. You know, in that me simping for there need to be more home runs always sort of point of view when I say awful. So
so let me understand this then. Let's bring this conversation full circle back to Camden. When we are looking at these numbers, we are only considering the distance change, not the wall height change. So it actually could be even worse.
Well, you know, you say that. I'm sure. No, it kind of like has like the both effect. And like, yeah, the wall.
It's not high enough to be an outlier like the monster.
Well, because it's both, it's not a problem, right? But like, basically, when someone hits the top of the monster, you know, it travels like 8 feet or whatever, right? And that's like its total distance that's recorded. I'm kidding, but I'm only slightly kidding. Like, what is the monster's distance, right?
It's you were gonna ask me that, and I don't know off the top of my head.
It's like, is it in the twos or is it just the really low threes?
No, I think it's the low three. I think it's 302 down the line. I'm gonna look it up as we talk here. So say some words, and I'm gonna find the dimensions here.
Right. So when someone hits it off the top of the monster, it officially goes, let's say, 310 feet or whatever, right? If someone hits it off the wall in that, like, carve out in Camden, like, it's gone farther than would be necessary to be a home run anywhere. And then on top of that, to add insult to injury, it's bouncing off a wall. So it's like they've done both of the bad things all at once.
Right. That's what I'm saying, though. So the wooded dong is taking into account the distance, but not the fact that the wall is a little bit higher, too, which is going to probably steal some as well. So it's 310 down the line, straight down the line. When you get to the end of the wall towards center field, it's 379, and then it goes back to 420.
Okay, yeah. So that sounds like, I know that there's more than a few parks where 370 would be pretty short for like halfway between center and in like the line.
Sure. So, but if you hit a ball that would have traveled, I don't know, 450, let's say,
and people have,
right, but you don't get it up and over the wall. People have hit the wall so hard, you're surprised that the ball doesn't embed in the monster. So I think it's 40 feet high. You know, it's not.
Yeah.
That's why it's called the Green Monster. I don't know. Maybe I'm overemphasizing the impact of the Orioles moving it back and up. But this, at the very least, this measurement is only taking into account the distance and not the trajectory that would be required to get it over that wall.
I think one way or another, we're kind of like picking at something that like shows like how the squirrels run around the wheels to get the gears moving. And, you know, picking at those little distant differences is always helpful, even if it's not quite the right thing. One way or another, Detroit, why you gotta just be bad that in terms of like dimensions? Also baseball, I guess, but like that's the other thing that shows up with this, is like I don't think about it as exceptional. It's just big.
I just moved this over into a conversation about how little you like the city of Detroit, so I'm glad that's not where you were going with that.
Oh no!
All right. Anything else you want to say about dimensions and weirdness? I these quirky things are a lot of fun, so I think it's awesome that you bring it up. I guess we never answered the question: should we care?
I think it's a nice sort of indicator. I actually went ahead and, because I was curious, I looked the other way on the one of 30 unicorns, and I was shocked at how many of them are the Cubs. You know, like how many of them are. You know, you think it'd be Yankee Stadium. I see 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh God, it's gonna be a lot more of these than I think it is. But yeah, it's like all Yankees and Cubs essentially. There are a couple unicorn Fenway shots that are just towering 320-foot home runs, if you will. But yeah, Wrigley is I guess I don't think about it as like just
Fenway also gives up those right down the line right field pesky pole.
They have one of those, yeah, as well. So yeah.
I mean, we it goes it. Straight back from there, so it's the overall impact of Pesky's pole being really short is fairly minimal. But when somebody does it, it's definitely it's noticeable. All right, why don't we move into our numbers of the week segment? And I don't know exactly whether or not you're going to want to play a guessing game here or not. We can, we don't have to. But I want to talk about a couple of things that I think are going to segue nicely into our main idea, our kind of big question, which is looking at kind of one-dimensional players and when they make sense to have on your roster and when they don't. And I want to look specifically at K percentage. Right now, there's 5 qualified players who have K percentages under 10%. But it
That's
is
good,
not.
Right?
It's a very good rate. But it's not. Names, I don't know. They were not names that I would have immediately jumped to. Here's what I want to do first. I'm going to read from 1 to 5, the WRC Plus associated in order with the K percenter. So the first number I'm going to give you is the person with the best K rate in baseball among qualifiers, their WRC plus. And then the second, and then the third, and the fourth, and the fifth. And then I want you to try and just, let's just say, guess the number one guy. And you can take a couple of chances at it. Because really, this discussion is, there's a direction I want to go with this. So we can have a little bit of fun. Right. I won't torture you too much, even though you did to me with the ballparks what I tend to do to you with this segment, week in and week out. So anyway, number one in K percentage. So the lowest K percentage among qualifiers has a WRC plus of 197.
That's very good.
Yes. The number two player, so the second best K percentage, second lowest among qualifiers, has a WRC plus of 109.
Not that great. That's good.
I mean, but not terrible, but certainly not 197. And I think this is starting to get to the idea of, like, you can be very good at one thing and not necessarily be all that much help on a fantasy roster, depending upon how your league is set up. So that's kind of where we're headed with this. The number three guy on this list has a WRC plus of 156. So back up again. The number four guy has one WRC plus of 104. And then the last player under 10% K rate among qualifiers has a WRC plus of 125. What does that say to you without looking at names? And then I'll have you try and just guess maybe a couple of these guys or whoever you think the best, the number one guy is. But talking about these are five players who strike out less than 10% of the time, and their WRC pluses are all over the place. So what is, just on the surface numbers-wise, what does that say to you?
I feel like it's probably good to not strike out. It's also good to just make sure that the thing that you do isn't ground out immediately. Like, there's a difference between hitting the ball and putting your bat on the ball. And I say that stealing those terms directly from some people who would say that so-and-so just needs to get his bat on the ball. Because that's, you know, I think about Stephen Kwan, who I don't know, I don't know if he's one of those guys, but he strikes me as a person who, like, will be on these lists in years to come. Yeah.
He is right now. Yep.
Yeah. And I often think, you know, we've talked about it a few times this year, and he's not been very good. He's been pretty okay. He walks enough that he provides value, but, like, he is simply staying alive with his bat way more often than people kind of think he is, which is like what happens when you've got no power.
As of late, earlier on in the season, he was performing pretty well across multiple categories, but certainly has come back to earth. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you know, my immediate thought there is, like, you need to make sure that you can do something that is better than a strikeout when you hit the ball. And obviously I'm sure some of these guys are doing a whole lot. Can I go ahead and give you my guess?
Yeah.
Is it Tim Anderson?
It is not Tim Anderson. Tim Anderson is number 12 on this list.
Oh, okay.
He's at 11.6% K rate.
Okay.
With a WRC plus of 164.
Okay. Okay. I didn't know how far it is falling, because he was like a 20% last year, and he was like, "Hey, what if I just don't?" Was kind of like the numbers takeaway, and I was like,
"That would be an interesting list. The greatest, like,
single season drop.
Yeah, like year over year. That would be an interesting list. That's not something I can just click on. I'd have to pull it and then, you know, compare.
Yeah,
it.
I was sitting in my car the other day, thinking, as one obviously does, about how I would best want to capture that. Would it just be like a simple subtraction, or would it be some sort of like percent change? And that's what I do for fun. So, you know, really fun at parties.
I think both are useful. Yeah, the raw number and then also percent change. I mean, you could just two columns, right? It's easy enough to do.
Yeah, for sure. God, so who never strikes out and is good? That's a really short list. Is it Jose Ramirez?
It is Jose Ramirez. Okay, yeah. You know what? Do you want to fathom a guess just for fun at what his K rate is?
Like 7?
Yeah, 7.6%.
Cheeps. Okay, yeah.
I guess 99.
I guess that is definitely like the... Wait, do you have his ISO in front of you?
Yes, 347.
I don't even know why, like, anyone, like, pitches to him. That's just disgusting. Okay. Like, I don't have anything more constructive to say than that. Jose Ramirez is good. The Guardians should just pay him, like, 50% more than his contract is, just for the sake of it. Wow. Okay. Yeah, no, I there's definitely, when we say, like, putting your bat on the ball, Jose Ramirez is doing a whole lot more than that. And I should note that when he was a prospect, we didn't expect him to. So that's another conversation, I think, in looking back retrospectively at what some of these guys could have been if they hadn't just started murdering the ball. But he's definitely not the topic of today's discussion, for sure. And I have, I have worried at times that some people like Tim Anderson could fall into today's discussion, but then no, that just didn't happen either.
He's
doing a lot of things really well this year, and I hope he's okay soon.
There is somebody that I want to talk about, and it can be 2 minutes before we kind of leave this numbers of the week segment and get into our central question. But I think it's a good player to bring up to kind of set the stage for what we're going to be talking about with our central question. And that's Luis Arraez, who has kind of gotten the reputation of being a one trick pony with his batting average. Now, he is hitting, let me just make sure I have this correct. He's hitting 351 right now, which is, if you're going to have one trick, that's a pretty good trick.
Yeah.
But he does have a WRC plus right now of 156. So I guess as a precursor to talking about when does a one-dimensional player or a one-category contributor merit rostering, how good does Arraez have to be, right, to break free of that? But can he get to a WRC plus of 156 just with a really good average?
I don't think so. Now, mind you, I want to say, when we talk about WRC plus, it does strip away some of the park factory things that people would get from, like, Coors. If we put Arraez and Coors, would he ever get out? Not sure. We should do more of that. The Rockies should be good. I think so Luis Arraez should be good, and the Rockies should have people like him. I think that'd be really fun. I think that there's a little bit more than just, like, put bat on ball a whole lot for him. And part of that is, you know, like, you don't get that good of a batting average while not striking out just by not striking out, right? He's got not a ton of pump, but does a pretty good job of making sure, like, the power he has, like, puts the ball in the right places for the most part. And is that all luck? It seems like it isn't at this point. We have to believe that he's going to be able to sustain, like, good placements of his balls onto the field, if that makes sense.
that is one way to put it.
So I think that that's part of the reason that he escapes a lot of these sorts of problems. I don't know. I feel like in my brain, he doesn't walk. Does he walk a lot? He's 13% this year. Yeah. So he also walks. Yeah. So that's part of it.
I was going to say, that's another piece of this too, is that his walk percentage is, I think, top 15 in the league.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I finally have him up properly, and he has a career sweet spot rate of, like, 40%. That's pretty good. And he's got a career line drive rate of some other good number. Let's see. 30%. So yeah, he's seems like he might have that skill, which is a really rare one. So there you go. Walk and only hit line drives. That's what you should do to be good.
Yeah. Well, it does seem like there are only a handful of people who have that as a skill set. It does kind of beg the question then, like, if he's that elite, like, beyond elite at something like that, right? Maintaining an above average line drive rate. Why is it that the batting average is kind of the only thing he often contributes? Is that because he, as a guy who hits 280, 290, he didn't have a spot in the lineup that allowed him to drive runs in? It's curious to me because
he is a plus in runs. So he will escape a little bit of discussion from us today. I just want to say hypothetically.
Yeah, but in the past, he hasn't been viewed as somebody who's a five-category contributor, or even more than maybe two, right, at best. Yeah. So I think he's very interesting. And I really do think, though, if you're going to have if you're going to need somebody to fill in, having somebody who hits, you know, 305 as their one category contribution is better than, you know, this guy might get a couple of RBI this week, but he's also going to hit 240, you know. And you're going to tell me if I'm right or I'm wrong when we get into our central question, which we will get into right after this very small break.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
And we are back. So, Alexander, I think this is a really cool question to ask, and I'm a little embarrassed that I never that we were at episode 61 and I never thought of this as a question. So all the kudos to you for kind of coming up with this as a point of interest. But I think it's really useful to think about for people in roto leagues or head-to-head categories leagues. How good does a one-tool player have to be to merit or be worth a roster spot on your team, especially if you're talking about deep, I'm not deep, the opposite of deep, shallow benches, where you only have a handful of spots, or you don't have IL spots and you have to stash those people on your bench. So I'm just going to kind of let you take this discussion away, and I'll jump in as I do. But I really think this is a very valuable question to ask.
So I'm going to start by giving a little bit of credit to the people who actually inspired this for me, whether positive or negative. It is where this comes from. So yeah, over the past couple of weeks, there's been what I would call a healthy and spirited amount of debate about whether Jorge Mateo is good enough to be rostered and started in fantasy leagues. There are some people who think he is a good fantasy asset because he is stealing an incredible number of bases because he is very fast. Then there are other people, and I would say my first thought was to agree with them. I want to make sure I say where I was before I looked into this at all, who thought this guy has a 250 OBP and shouldn't be starting for any double A team. How can he possibly be good for your fantasy team? And like, that's a bit of an exaggeration, et cetera, et cetera. But like, he strikes out a lot. He never walks. He does not hit the ball hard. That's not a good combination. He's playing in an increasingly terrible park most of the time. He's a right-handed hitter in Camden. Like, that's not a good place to be. So like, my thought was like, there's no way he can possibly be contributing value. So Mike Kurland and Brad Johnson are like the two most recent people who have kind of like put forward this discussion and like thread.
Kurland's been on Mateo since like preseason. So we got to give him a little bit of credit there in terms of this discussion.
Absolutely. And to his credit, when I looked it up, the answer seemed to be that so far, if you're like in the most default FanGraphs calculator settings, I just pulled like what you would call like a 12 team NFBC setting, which I think is a pretty fair way of looking at this. It's like a 12 team deep ish lineup, but also two catchers. So I'm like, there's some two catcher effects in here later we'll get to, and I'm just kind of ignoring them because we'll talk about it. But yeah, this is like what I think is a pretty standard amount of like players in a pool. And he's been roughly the 11th best shortstop this year. So yeah, he, by all metrics, has deserved to be starting most of the year. Now, there have been guys who have been better than him on a per game basis and then have gotten hurt at a bunch of different levels. It is worth considering whether he is like really, really worth starting or just barely on the edge. But the idea definitely here is, even if he's missing a few games here and there, he's stealing enough bags that you feel probably compelled to start him no matter what. And so for players like this, I want to just go with the most basic, no like per game adjustments, just throw it in there sort of stuff, and we'll do our own math around the edges. I thought it was really interesting to consider this sort of problem because finally we have someone that doesn't even hit enough home runs to like be in that Mondesi trap. Like, this is someone who is actively hurting you in four categories, and by steals alone seems like he merits some consideration. And that is
Billy
such
Hamilton
a fun
factor.
Idea. Yeah, yeah. Like, but like, not even the runs are positive here. That's where we're at. We're talking nine hole Billy Hamilton sort of stuff. So if you look at the Orioles on the roster research page, which, you know, a fun place to be if you're looking for a good time on a Wednesday night, it's not pretty. Mateo has been batting like bottom third, 7, 8, 9 over the past while. Like, he has no real business being anywhere near the top of the lineup where he would actually generate any sort of counting stats. He actually does have a positive war. He's been worth about like one win because his defense has been excellent. Like, he is a good defensive shortstop right now, which is fun, actually, out of all of this. I'm like, I'm glad he is contributing. Like, we talked about Arias a minute ago. He's like not a good defender. Just not great. But Mateo's been like really good defensively and a good base runner. And the other part of this, I want to make sure I bring up, he's had extremely good like batted ball luck in terms of line drives version, you know, like the are you like syncing everything up. In spite of that, he can't hit the ball hard to save his life, and he strikes out a ton. It's really not a recipe for success. And all that, around the 11th, 12th best shortstop through this part of the season, he's been a $2 or so player. So what this got me thinking on more like holistically, it's like, yes, we want to figure out like how good do you have to be to like be in his role. So where's he at right now? Through right this second, but not today, he's got a 29.6% strikeout rate and a 3.6% walk rate for a 225 average and a 250 OBP. That is not start a whole lot of games numbers.
Yeah,
he's got 3 home runs, 13 steals, 12 RBI, so he has more steals than RBI, and 14 runs through 45 games / 169 PA. This is like roughly, if you want to like extrapolate it out, this is pretty close to what, like, three, multiply those by like 3.5 and you have like his rest of season pace. So we're talking like that's a 10 home run pace, actually. It's also like a 50 run / RBI pace. It's also like a 45 steal pace. Or, you know, what am I doing that right? Yeah, I think so. Like 45-ish steal pace. So like that's what we're looking at. 10, 45, 225, and then 100 combined runs on RBI. That is really bad in four categories.
Right.
Just for some, like, if you're curious for what an average contribution. So this is not helping you, not hurting you in terms of the context of the whole league. Not, this is not a $1 player. This is a $10 player. So like we want to compare against. We projected before the season, before like the ball died, that you'd be looking at like 25 home runs, 10 steals, 260, and then like 75-80 each from runs and RBI. So you're losing 50 runs in RBI, 15 home runs, like from one player out of like 12 or 13 batters. We're losing like 40 points of batting average. That's like 3 points of batting average for your whole team in exchange for 35 extra steals. And that is what it takes to be like effective. That's what we're looking at the trade-off being. Now, mind you, he's probably benefiting from the fact that a lot of people aren't hitting as many home runs, which is kind of an interesting bit of all of this. It's easier to be Jorge Mateo this year when everyone else is being bad too, if you're doing his things. So he's like a really interesting sort of case. I don't know. Do you roster him anywhere? Do you ever intend to roster anyone like him?
I do. I have him, and he's the guy that I kind of slot in, and I'll manage my week. And if it looks like over the course of a weekend, I might be able to, if his two steals over the course of the weekend might win me that category, then I'll slot him in. Or, you know, on a day where there's an empty spot in my outfield that nobody's playing.
So is it more of a head-to-head thing then?
Yes, that's okay. That's really where I play head-to-head. And in a roto situation, I'm going to be honest, roto is not my best format. I still have a hard time getting out of that week-to-week mindset, and it's okay if somebody's really bad for a little while, as long as they're also really good for a little while later on, because at the end of the year, it all kind of evens out. That's not my headspace that I've ever had with fantasy. I've always played in weekly head-to-head leagues, whether it's been points or categories. But, you know, steals are super scarce. So, again, if I'm going to the heap, right, the waiver wire to get somebody to fill in, I would rather have it be somebody that's elite at that. But it also, and this is something I was going to bring up, I guess later, I'll do it now. I have teams where I'm not getting super hurt with average because my team is putting up pretty robust averages. Getting to the point where I was losing that category every week, or, you know, they weren't getting a lot of RBI or runs or whatever, then, you know, you have to look at that and say, okay, I probably need to compensate there. I'm very curious from a mathematical standpoint, if you were to take somebody like Arias and pair him with Mateo purposefully, you're now using up two roster spots, right?
Yes.
But they're each contributing the thing that the other one doesn't.
Sure.
Is that net positive or is that net negative? And this is a genuine question. I don't know.
I mean, basically the way you want to think about it is I always think back to the $10 player. Yeah, you're going to have a few players who are not going to be anywhere near there. It's probably worth, you know, knock those all down a little bit to think about your like hypothetical $1 player, but you don't want any of those guys. You need right. your team to be better than your opponent's teams, not better than the waiver wire. So a player is as good then as how far away from that average you want to be. You know, you want your team to be on average worth more than $10 contribution each. They want to like total out to more than that, whatever. So, you know, so if Mateo is netting, like his pace is looking like it'd be like, if he keeps this up, he'd be like a $5 or $6 guy in the most extreme and hilarious way. It's worth noting that a dollar is actually the break even because they like give you a $1 minimum bid in this case. So we're going to look at guys who have been like bad in four categories, good in one, with a total net positive. $1 is actually like the break even positive case in those of these. If you have a $1 minimum bid in your salary cap setup or whatever. So right,
that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's like, he's at $2. He's not going to finish at $8. He's going to finish at like $5 if he keeps this up. And question mark, because I don't think the bad of ball luck keeps up. And I don't think the playing time keeps up either. There are some people in that system who will eventually, be it August or wherever, be clamoring for some playing time that he is currently providing. And God, 250 OBP, like that's a war crime. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds to me like if you're looking at two spots and you're pairing guys, you want $20 worth of value from those two roster spots. And if you're ideally, taking a $5 guy and a $7 guy, then you're just doubling down on being under the value you want to be at.
I mean, but the thing is, like, you have to have those guys on your roster somewhere. So what I think you want to do then is, like, we're setting that up as, like, a here's how I generally think. Where you could run into that is like you don't want to be digging a gigantic hole between your like bad guys in one direction that you're really forcing the first through fifth round hitters or whatever you drafted to like really be carrying, right? I like to have some balance in what they're bad at, just as like I want balance in what my top end guys are good at, because it just makes my life full of fewer headaches. And also like, you know, that also just makes it so that like if the shuffling of things happens, people get hurt, you know, at least you have a plan. So if you have
and you're
Mateo,
talking more like season long roto now with that strategy, right?
I mean, because even then, if I'm like thinking about that, is like I'm filling in
live
weekly head to head.
I'm live thinking this. So I apologize. I keep interrupting you. We don't usually talk over each other all that much. I'm doing it a lot today. I am sorry. If, if I have decided that I'm punting steals in favor of being really loaded in other categories, mm-hmm. then I have zero reason to roster Mateo.
Oh, yeah.
And well, you can get away with punting a category, right?
Yeah.
In head-to-head better than you can in Roto. So in that sense, I think that is relevant, right? Tell me, you can tell me I'm wrong. It's okay.
See, my thought about punting steals is I like to do it on draft day, but you don't like give up a guy who's good at steals in season necessarily. It's just you're not spending any of your money on it. And if you happen to find a guy on the wire who's going to steal some bases, or, you know, some of your like dart throw guys end up stealing more than you think, you're happy about that. You know, I have a punt steal head to head team that won steals last week, and I'm pretty happy with it. What a good week.
You don't need Mateo on that team, I guess, is right. What I'm saying. So you don't, he doesn't really even come into your purview in that context.
Well, the thought is that he's hurting me in the categories I'm trying to win. And
right.
The question then is a much higher chance of winning steals worth it? And, you know, the way that these things all shake out is, well, the numbers should balance out, and if he comes out positive, he's not hurting you that much, right? And that's, it's a rough way to have to think about all that, because that's never really quite true, right? There's always going to be closer margins in places than others. The reason I like to punt steals is because there's just not that many of them, which means it comes out to be random, and so my steal punt team can still win steals. But like, if you're running like an accidental home run punt team, you're not going to win home runs. If you run an accidental RBI punt team, that's just a bad team, right? You draft a lot of leadoff hitters, whatever you want to call it, but like, that's why I punt steals. So that's why this is also so interesting, is like you draft from those teams and you're like, oh yeah, I'm so good in 9 of 10 categories, I guess I can roster Mateo. I accidentally did. And or, like, if that's your situation, like, this all just comes out to, I want to show where that line is, so that in 3 or 4 weeks, whenever you're like, okay, Mateo has still 12 RBI or whatever it is. I don't think he's going to have 12 RBI in week 10. You know, let's call it 15 RBI. And it's ugly, and you're still trotting him out there. Like, is he helping you? Right now, with his exceptionally good luck, it's still just barely positive. So I want to say, okay, like, if you're in the camp that, yeah, I've been getting good results out of him, good for you. Don't expect it to keep up, is my thought.
Sure. Yeah. You need to be very aware of the trends, right? Because there's going to be a point at which you probably are going to dip into that negative space. So I think we've elaborated on the concept here, right? Everybody kind of gets what it is we're talking about. Why don't you talk about some other category, one category guys, and maybe, you know, 3-4 minutes on each, and kind of how this translates over to, say, home runs or RBI. If you're an elite RBI person, is it different than being an elite stolen base person? Do you need to be an outlier in a larger way? Like, does it take that many more to get two standard deviations above the mean in a different category? So you really have to find people who are exceptional. And can you be elite at RBIs without being really good at home runs? Right. Like, where do these things kind of come into play? I guess stolen bases is a very obvious category to go to for being a one category contributor. These other mm-hmm. ones might get a little bit more muddy. So
I put together what I am calling the Monkey's Paw All-Star Team. These are the guys that you pick up because you need some help in one category, and the Monkey's Paw Curls. And, well, they help you in one category. So the criteria I set here is I pulled like the year-to-date FanGraphs auction calculator, 12-team NFBC setting, et cetera, dudes. This Wednesday morning, so like one stolen base or home run might push someone in one direction or the other.
Yeah, that's true.
But whatever, you know, you get the point. Yes. I also didn't click the experimental button I usually hit, because again, if you're drafting a guy for help in one category, you're probably playing him no matter what, barring injury. There are some people on this list who have been injured. We'll talk about it. It's really good to know where things break, so I left him in. And you're not wrong in that steals are definitely one of the categories that shows up more. I set the initial criteria as you have to be 50 cents bad, like 50 cents below average in four categories, and then positive in the other. And then, like, realistically speaking, that doesn't get you to, like, positive total value always. So I want to talk about where Jorge Mateo is at, because it's so funny. He's a dollar down, a dollar 10 down on average, a dollar 40 down on RBI, a dollar 20 down in runs, 350 in stolen bases, and 93 cents down in home runs, for a total dollar after, like, the positional contribution of 203. So if you extrapolate that out, multiply by about 3.5, he's looking at being, let's see, if can I do 3.5 times 3.5? Most days I can. You know, it's somewhere in like $12, which is like more than like about 1.5 standard deviations in terms of steals. Like, no, way more than that. It's gonna be way more than that. Wow. Okay, because we're talking, like, like I said, a 45 steal pace, a standard deviation is about 9. Yes, he's gonna be looking at like 3 or 4 standard deviations above. Which, but he's also insane. Like, going to be more than 1 or 2 down in every other category. Just an extreme, yeah, dude. Right, so right. Funny.
You're also talking about him with shortstop eligibility, right?
If that doesn't change much here, actually.
Okay, so if you run it as an outfield, it doesn't significantly drop his positional value to take a big bite out of that $2?
No, the only one that really changes things that much, more than like more than a few cents, is catcher. So I, among the guys who come out as a positive at all, like just above zero, and qualifying like the steals version of this, are Eli White for Texas, who has 93 plate appearances. So yeah, I think he'll actually be better if he's playing full time, but I don't, is he? Probably not. And Christian Bethencourt for the Oakland A's, who is catcher eligible and has 100 PAs, and like he's a positive because he's catcher eligible. Like, that's it. Again, the plate appearances are like, it breaks everything. There are some guys who are farther down the value outputs, though, who are playing full time, that are like, they just don't net out to being a positive, but they do help you in steals while hurting you in all the other categories. And I thought I should drop some of their names in because it's kind of interesting. Andrew McCutchen, he was hurt or COVID for a second. Tony Kemp, Ahmed Rosario, who I drafted way higher than my gut told me I should have this year, and I do regret it. Jared Kelnick technically qualifies in this, as do Adalberto Mondesi and Paul DeJong. None of them are playing in the majors right now, as far as I know. Obviously Al Garcia, another kind of like disappointing playing most of the time guy. So there's actually a lot of people who kind of fit this mold. Mateo is like the only one who's still been like worth starting out of all of them, hypothetically.
So what about moving on to, let's say, home runs?
Yeah, so this one's interesting in that because home runs correlate with RBI, there's not that many people who qualify. Mitch Garver and Sal Perez are both catchers who fit this mold. Solo shots, as it turns out, are not great. And Abram Toro for the Seattle Mariners, who is, according to Fangraphs, first base, second base, third base, and DH eligible with the things I put in, which is really funny. But he's hurt you on the year. He's just not playing a ton, which doesn't help. He hasn't been that positive with home runs. He's been worth 3 cents of home runs. So he has like, he's exactly average.
Yeah.
So it's like he barely qualifies. This is a category, though. It's like there are people that are 2 and 3 category contributors for home runs that are really killing you in average, right? Or really not getting you that many runs despite their home runs because they're only batting themselves in, basically.
Yeah, right, right.
So you're going to have guys who are like this. They're just not going to be one category guys.
So why don't we talk about RBIs, since that's kind of the companion category for home runs?
Yeah, no one came out net positive in this case. The one guy who shows up in RBI that's like significantly up and then way down on all the other ones is Alex Verdugo. But yeah, he's been like way down on everything except for RBI. And that makes sense in a way, right? He hasn't been great. He's hitting what, like, is he hitting 6th or so? Is he hitting? He's not that part of the order for Boston, right?
That sounds right.
Yeah. So then if you imagine yourself hitting about 6th or 7th for a reasonably good team, you're going to get a good number of like opportunities to bat someone in, but if you get on, like, someone behind you is not going to bat you in. And if you just haven't had the average and the steals and the home runs, we're just talking like sac flies and singles and doubles being like the entire source of your fantasy production. And, you know, it does make sense how you can be a good RBI guy without being really a great player. There's got to be a couple other guys who are like net positive in home runs for the moment who fit in here. I imagine there are some guys who just don't even have the RBI to do this, but like that's where any of their value has come from so far. So yeah, that was an interesting one for me.
Is interesting to me because it's like the one category you can net while making outs, right?
Yeah.
So that can play into that too. All right, what about runs? Let's talk about runs.
There's exactly one player who shook out in this, and it is, well, good team, has scored a lot, has not been very good, and that's Eduardo Escobar. Again, he's been in a net negative for you, but he's been mildly positive in runs and just really bad at everything else, like you'd think. So like, it's hard to be in that mold, but if it is, it's, I drafted a player on a good team. The playing time hasn't been great. When he plays, the Mets score a bajillion runs. When he doesn't play, the Mets score a bajillion runs. So like, he's been good in your lineup on those days ish, but he's not stealing. I kind of worried that his home runs last year like wouldn't be all that sustainable, because he's kind of a guy who hits a whole lot of home runs without a ton of hard contact. You just optimized like spray and stuff like that and some luck. And now that the ball is on vacation, his home runs are too. And so it's been mediocre. And I had him in a league or two where I drafted him kind of mid-late, and he's been benched. And I haven't felt bad about it because...
Yeah.
Seems like I shouldn't have.
All right, let's bring this full circle back to where we started talking about Luis Arias and his insane batting average and ability to kind of do that as a skill, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in this sort of baseball climate, and talk about other players who are average specialists who probably don't have WRC pluses north of 150.
Yeah, average is actually one of the things where you can be a net positive with really low plate appearance totals. So this list is super long, and I'm trimming it on purpose as a result. I'm really only going to look at the people who have at least 150-ish PAs. And there are actually some really interesting names in here. I want to start off that the most positive of these people has been Alejandro Kirk, who had a really good night the other night and pushed himself up this list. He's been like net $3, so like subtract one, multiply by 3.5, and we're looking at, you know, like a $10-ish season from him pace, and he's getting better. This separately, I really believe in him, and I'm really excited for him. The other names on this list are really intriguing. Trey Mancini has been a mild net negative, really, really helping you in average. Really, really nothing else is happening there. Yet another case of the Camden Yards. Michael Brantley is kind of exactly who we thought he is, except the average hasn't been that good. Like, he's like mildly positive and hurting you just enough to qualify basically everywhere else. So he's been a 30-cent player this year. Kind of funny. Some other names that fit in for some other reasons. Carlos Correa has been hitting the ball really hard with like bad results, but has had a decent batting average, like not enough home runs. The Twins have been not providing him a lot of counting stats. He doesn't steal. So like literally no stolen bases last year, none this year. So yeah, he's like exactly kind of fits into this. Miguel Cabrera also, positive average, similar sort of thing. Detroit, not a good place to be hitting. So yeah, a lot of like people you'd expect. And then there's a bunch of catchers. If you stroll farther down the list, you're gonna find a whole lot of names who qualify for like barely any PAs, and it's kind of funny to just like watch the data spit it at you and just laugh. Like Williams Astudillo is on this list with 11 PAs, and good for him. Of course he is, but you know, it's funny. So yeah, I figured I should name drop like how that works out. There really aren't that many people who fill out this way, but there are a lot of people who are going to be really close in some different directions, and it's quite funny how that all shakes out. The reasons why you should care about any of these names, though, is you can go look at them, see what their paces are, and see that For example, I'll pull up Michael Brantley because I feel obligated to. He's always a good example of this. And you can look him in past years, and you can run this exact same approach, by the way, for all of 2021, and you'll get yourself a really helpful version of this for like a larger thing. But yeah, 16 runs, 16 RBIs. So that's 32 combined. He's looking at, you know, like a total pace for the season then of like 120 or so, like 60 and 60. Like, that's not great. He's got three home runs, one steal. Like, that's not great. He's batting 267. That's not enough to be helping you. He probably needs to be batting 300 to be worth rostering.
Right. And he has been closer to 300 in years past. So yeah, that's a disappointment for sure from him.
I would note that if some balls were falling for him, that he's still got a great lineup spot, and I imagine the counting stats should be there. So like, I actually do think that in a good number of leagues, especially deeper leagues, like, I probably would be picking him up if he's on the wire. I don't think he's on the wire necessarily, you know, like in a 15, right? In a 12, he's on my watch list or on my bench, and I'm like happy with that. He is who we thought he is. Nothing's really changed that severely. It's just like the ball's dead, but he kind of hit singles and doubles anyways, so it's not like dying in the air all that much for him. He actually does hit the ball really hard still, right? It's just like it wasn't hanging in the same way. So like,
interesting guy. Yeah. Now, and the new ball certainly probably playing a role for a player like that. I guess the takeaway, it sounds like to me then, is that for the most part, you have to be amazing at one category to be worth rostering as a one category contributor. I mean, beyond. You're talking with Mateo like three standard deviations above the mean. That's an insane that you're talking about like 1% of 1% of the league, right? At that
and
stage.
I imagine he probably isn't playing nearly as much. Like even for the Orioles, if not for some of this stuff, because I bet they think it's fun. And they're right. It is. But if he was just defensively good, 250 OBP, I bet he doesn't get the sort of run. And probably, is he running?
Right. Yeah, because that's really valuable for real baseball. Not doesn't help our fantasy teams, but they're playing real baseball theoretically, at least in Baltimore. I would be interested, and I'm not giving you a homework assignment because I think it would probably get very complicated quickly, but I would be interested to see how this changes when you start talking about two categories. So somebody who, like you were talking about before, hits a ton of home runs, gets a lot of RBI, but hits, you know, 215. Doesn't steal, doesn't necessarily score many runs other than the ones that he drives in himself. So I would wonder where the math would tell us that value is.
I bet.
And you might have an idea.
I bet I could like set my parameters to be more negative and then more positive to see how many people show up. You know, that's the other thing is like, I want to know how many of these people even exist. It's a question that we're not good at answering because we don't have to, right? Like,
yeah.
How often do we roster people who are this bad and then also this specifically good at a thing that doesn't matter? It doesn't happen, right? This is the reason why, you know, you've heard people in years past, like, you know, Saris after the excellent year for Baltimore, saying like, he's not good at defense, he's not gonna play, and so you shouldn't be drafting him to be a steal specialist because like, he doesn't have the goods to stay in the lineup. At this point, like, we're seeing Mateo stay in the lineup not for his bat, and it's interesting, and like, I'm curious to see how long it holds up, but like, these are the cases that don't present themselves for a reason. And I think that's kind of like the other closing thing is like, if you're in a dynasty league, sell Mateo. If you're in a redraft league and you can afford to at all steals wise, you probably should as well. Like, there's nothing about this that screams, this is a guy that I want to be buying right now, despite everything else, even with my assessment that he hasn't been hurting you. That's not a reason to go buy. Like, if anything, this is like the triple sell to don't buy Arrested Development bit. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's the perfect place for us to conclude this episode. Thank you for joining me. And if you could remind the people where they could find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at @TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at @Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure
to subscribe to the Pitcher List podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.